Yesterday I went to do a funeral and I went to a funeral ceremony. It was so much fun. I enjoyed it so much. It was a bit like a movie, really. And I didn't know funerals in America could be so much fun. Are they always that much fun? It's just fantastic. And we started off, we did some prayers, and we started off with some chanting. I put the ceremony together, so I had to be careful what I say. And then the lady, she came and she said to me, I really want to do a Buddhist kind of style funeral and the ceremony. And her husband died, and seems like a really amazing man, very, very, very kind man. And so we put it together, and it started off with Om Mani Padme Hum chanting, and then the Heart Sutra, and the Four Immeasurables and the Heart Sutra. And then everyone lit a candle and offered to the Buddha. And then we did the prayer of St. Francis. And then and then this is the really interesting part, right? Everyone came up and started talking about this person that I had never met. And it was like the whole person's life just kind of poured out. And even the ex-wife came and, you know, she said, I'm so glad he married you. And it got so emotional and intense. So I'm really glad he married you. and all the students came, and there's nobody here from that. Anyway, it was just very, very moving, very touching. And at the end, we did a King of Prayers. So this wanted to share. Yeshigatsu has this incredibly beautiful voice, and he is actually Venerable Yeshigatsu and His Holiness the Dalai Lama at Shoreline. So, yeah, he was at Shoreline. So I was going to, instead of me croaking Om Mani Padme Hum, I was going to ask him to do Om Mani Padme Hum a little bit. Yeah? Oh, maybe 2-3 minutes. Okay with everybody? Yeah, so you can either join in. If you can, the only thing is his voice is so beautiful. Sometimes a little bit hard to join in. But,
Did you bring your CD? It's still in Hollywood, actually.
The CDs and the T-shirt. Anyway, this is Venerable Yeshigatsu live, everybody.
I'm plugged.
Om Mani Padme Hum.
Om Mani Padme Hum.
Over, I think it's about 2 years I've been here, and the various different, you know, different talks, so many different talks, so much talking, Tuesday nights, and on the one hand I was feeling kind of happy because people coming to see me and they're all saying, you know, it's helpful, and I always felt the best thing to do is just to talk from the heart about things that I was going through and how I was viewing those things and how I was dealing with them, and to just let that kind of resonate as that made sense to people. So I think, you know, that's what I was kind of trying to do. I thought, I'm better than reading something from a book that is not connecting. But then I did feel some regret because I felt, you know, all these many talks, but I never explained how to do a single prayer. And I never went through the Lam Rim, aside from doing Rupa Rinpoche's teachings, when we had the experiential teachings. You know, I didn't go through the Lam Rim. When I first came here, I started giving talks on Thubten Sampo's 37 practices. And then it just became like every week, talking about different things. So I felt some kind of regret, like, you know, I should have done a bit better. I should have presented, like, the standard way how to meditate, and I hadn't been able to do that. So then I was thinking, maybe tonight I might just go a little bit through that, like the standard way of presenting the teachings rather than talking my usual kind of way. And then I was thinking about the 6 weeks. It's 6 weeks, I think, since I came back from Tibet, and I was thinking about the different subjects that we covered. And I know some people came to all 6 weeks. There's some people here who are new, aren't there? There's always some people who are new. So you just have to let things flow over and just have to see how it goes. But I thought actually it was kind of quite interesting. So I never know what I'm going to talk about before I come down. And I thought actually we've covered quite a lot of things in those 6 weeks. And I thought to just go over that and put it all together and then do something about the standard Lam Rim teachings. And I remember when I first got back from Tibet, and the first talk that I had to give, I say had to give because, you know, it's like, it's always, in the old days, I live up in a cabin, in the old days, I always, every Tuesday night, kind of praying nobody would come. always somebody would come. But I had a huge, actually I think I've always had a huge resistance to giving talks, but I had to sort of go through that. Anyway, so people did come. So I remember the first talk that I had to give was actually we were doing the fasting practice. So I hadn't had anything to eat or drink. And I remember I was talking about my experience having just come back from Tibet. And I thought I was comparing it with 15 years ago when I first went to Tibet and all the impressions and feelings. It was a very, very powerful time for me because, first of all, I was there with my teacher. Secondly, it was extremely different from 15 years ago. And like for us as a Tibetan Buddhist, clearly, I mean, Tibet is so much on the agenda. So many of our teachers are from Tibet. So many things we study are from Tibet. And it's like when we grew up in England, we hear all these words, you know, Chicago, Arkansas, California, and it's like, oh, America. And you watch all these movies, and they're based in Boston or this or that, and you go, oh, wow, America. And then when you come to America, it's like, oh, wow, you know, amazing, amazing. I'm actually in New York. I'm actually in Boston. It's kind of like that. So it's a similar thing when you've been studying Buddhism for 20 years from the Tibetan tradition, and suddenly you're back in Tibet, and they're saying, well, look, you know, this is where this teacher was born, and this is this teacher's monastery, and this is where this great master wrote. And they're talking about all these texts that you studied. It's very extraordinary. And then, of course, gradually, both trips were overland, so gradually you arrive in Lhasa. And when you come to Lhasa, in Lhasa, it's like the forbidden city. And there you see the Potala towering above you. And you actually get to go and see where His Holiness lived and where He studied and where He was. All the different Dalai Lamas who've taken care of Tibet over the generations and centuries are enshrined in these extraordinary stupas and all the statues they've built. And you go into the bedroom and it's like full of thousands of statues of Tara or Chenrezig or, you know, texts written in gold. And it's an amazing experience. And also there's the famous place called the Jokan, and you go, it's to the closest thing to Disneyland. Actually, I think Disneyland is based on the Jokan. I think the first Tibetan king, Thongsen Gampo, he basically invented Disneyland. Except that this particular place, you go into it, and there's all these different chapels, and you go into one, it's like the eight medicine Buddhas, you know, the Taras, and then you go into another, and it's like Chenrezig who talks, and then there's Tara coming out the wall who kind of, you know, flew or did this, and you look at this and your eyes are cured because Manjushri, and it's like this is where this happened, and then finally you get to the most holy Buddha image, which was bought at the very beginning when Tibet became Buddhist by the first Tibetan king had two wives, one from China and one from Nepal, and you approach this hallowed image and it's almost like it's glowing with nuclear energy. So many prayers have been directed towards this image. And, you know, you get to bump your head against it, and you get to do your prayers, and you can offer, you know, you as you go around these places, you take either a little bag of butter and a stash, a wad of little notes, and a stash, you know, a bag of cutters, these white silk scarves, and every time you come to one of these images, you put a scarf there, and you put a bit of butter, or you carry a little butter lamp with you, and in front of all these images are butter lamps, and you pour a little bit of butter in, and you pray to all these amazing beings. Butter lamps truly, truly had butter in them in the old days. These days they have all kinds of things in them. Well, these days it's all these electric lotuses. But those days, actually, but those days it was butter lamps, and you know, butter lamp has all these qualities you'll read in the text, and it's food offering, it's a smell offering, it's a light offering, it's a scent offering, because when you burn butter, all these different things happen. So in front of these images, sometimes you have huge gold butter lamps the Dalai Lama offered, or, you know, these or that holy being. And you read about all these places and things, and so it's truly extraordinary to be in the presence. You really truly feel with these images that the any minute they're going to kind of talk to you and say, oh, I'm so glad you made it. You know, isn't this fun? It's like the most fun thing to go and into these little places and make these little offerings and do these little prayers and pray to them, and, you know, may I become enlightened and may I develop compassion and may I become just like you, and offer them katas, and it's just extraordinary. And of course, it's not just you, but there are all these other people, crowds of people, all going around doing the same thing. And they're turning their prayer wheels and they're reciting their mantras, and that the depth of devotion and feeling is extraordinary. You get people who are kind of wizened by prayer, almost. You get these old women. When you reach a certain age in Tibet, you go and you hang out and you do this full time. That's what you do. So I remember Rinpoche, I think it was, made a comment that he always felt very sad in Western countries that the old people don't have anything to do. They sit around in these old people's homes. And of course in Tibet there's so much to do, because that's the best time. You've done your life, you've had your kids, and now you just get to pray and be with the Buddhas, and then from morning to night you do what you want to do, and you can go to these places and offer your butter lamps, and they take a big thermos of tea and they go off. And they sit in front of the debacle, and they do the prostrations. Even the old ones, they're reciting their little prayers that maybe they memorized 70, 80 years ago, and it's coming out gobbledygook, but it doesn't matter, because they know what they're saying. I mean, they're connecting, right? They know what they're saying, and there's communication going on. And I'm sure it's like going to see the Buddhas. it's truly like a Buddha field for them. They go and they don't see a separation between these statues and the Buddhas, and their minds of course get more and more and more pure. So when it comes to time to die, it's like, you know, just take me, I'm ready. Let's go. Who wants this body? It's finished. Just let's go. Come on, I'm ready. No problem. So they have this incredible joy. And at the same time, I think all the good energy that they're creating just attracts the children to them. You know, I don't know if you ever, when you were younger, you had a favorite aunt or a favorite granny, but 10 to 1 it was somebody kind who used to give you things and care about the kids. And it wasn't somebody who used to grump and say, don't eat this and you've got to eat that and behave at the table. It was someone who was just very loving and kind. And of course they become very loving and kind. They take the samas, they go and sit there and they do this practice, they turn the prayer, they have a gossip. It's fun. 1 minute they're doing mantra, turning prayer words, the next minute it's just the prayer words and the gossip. It's fun. The same thing Dharamsala, they're going round and round the palace. My teacher, he always says, those fortunate old mothers, he says, who get to circumambulate the palace every day and just be there, living out their life in a very spiritual way. And then they die. And many of them, when they come to die, of course, it's a very good experience. People see things. They die very happily, very peacefully. And that puts a strong effect. Well, so, you know, it's very kind of powerful for us to go and see this. And the first time I had been to Lhasa was a time when there was a kind of newfound freedom. And people truly believed, well, we've been through so much oppression, maybe 30 years it was then, 35 years, I think, of oppression and torture and fear and degradation and occupation. But actually, mainly the place was Tibetan, and there were garrisons and there were settlers, but basically it was Tibetan. And the old there were still many teachers, those who'd gone through the torture, but they'd come out and they were there. There were many teachers visiting, there were many Western students visiting, there were many Western monks and nuns visiting. And it was a time, it was kind of like a Prague spring, a time of great freedom, a bit like Tiananmen Square, actually. Sad to make that comparison. But a bit like Tiananmen Square, I mean, you've got Westerners hanging out there making their peanut butter to survive, and people having little Dharma book libraries, and you could go and stay in any hotel you wanted, and you could just hang out and be there like Kathmandu in the old days. And it was really pretty cool. And the Tibetans, you could talk to them, and it was very emotional to talk to them. They'd all come up to you and they'd ask for pictures, and they'd be pulling at you and ask you to give blessings, and they'd be crying, and they'd be telling their story, and they'd just hold your hand and they'd say, please, 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 you know, we just want His Holiness to come back. We've suffered so much, please. And they're just thinking about His Holiness, and they're begging for photos, and they're begging for blessings. And I said, you know, my teacher would just spend hours and hours and hours blessing every single one. And you'd see all these old people coming up, and you'd see the young people coming up. And you'd also see the secret police coming up with little smirks on their face. And of course, he'd spend longer blessing them. And he'd hand wads of money to them, and they'd be like, whoa, what's going on? And you'd be thinking, you know, why is he being so kind to these people? And then you'd realize that they were the ones that really needed it. But basically, there was this sense of hope and freedom, and maybe, maybe now Tibet will be free. And we used to do pujas in a big group, many monks and nuns all together, very public. Tibetans would all come up, they'd offer things, they'd look at you, they'd just like tears in their eyes. For years they've been told Tibetan Buddhism is primitive, it's nothing, it's like worthless, it's like you have been subjugated by these people, they've tricked you, it's barbaric, the modern world doesn't think like this. And there's this huge congregation of Western monks and nuns with little radios listening to the Dharma, because you know, you have like 70 people, how do you communicate? By FM radio, yeah? And with cameras slung around them, taking pictures, making prostrations, open teachings being given. I mean, just incredible, incredible stuff. Tibetans talking in English, giving teaching, just incredible, mind-blowing stuff. They had the Chinese shaking I mean, they were amazed. They'd never seen this. You know, they'd kind of always bought the party line. And the Tibetans were just like so happy to see this. And they'd be supporting you, and you'd be in, wherever you went, because we went many places, you'd be in the middle of a field, and suddenly from nowhere, these Tibetans would appear running along with, like, you know, a little table and a place for the Lama to sit, and carrying those thermoses, or with a pot, and suddenly there'd be twigs, they'd be making a fire, and they'd be offering tea, and they'd be offering sampa, and they'd be mixing, you know, bringing, it was just, you know, it was an amazing time. 15 years later, and the hope was gone. The hope had been taken out of people's hearts, and we can't even wear our robes. And nobody comes and asks for a picture of the Dalai Lama, and you don't give them out, because you know that if you make contact with anybody or you hand out a picture of the Dalai Lama, that person's going to get in trouble, and the whole group's going to get in trouble, and your tour guide is going to get in trouble. And maybe even your teacher is going to get in trouble. So you keep your eyes down, you keep in like two or threes or just ones, and you don't openly show that you're praying. Maybe you go somewhere, but even if you do go in a group, the doors are locked. Even, you know, we do a puja in this Jokang, the most holy, precious place, but there ain't no Tibetan allowed there. All the monks are told to go, you know, get out of that place, and every door is locked. And you can't even go inside where the Buddha is. You just sit in the courtyard. And you know, as you're sitting in that courtyard, that not just the Dalai Lama's throne is there, where he taught for centuries during the great Monlam festival, and many holy beings taught and walked through that place that, you know, we still think about, but also monks were thrown from the roof to their deaths, you know, just 10, 15 years ago, tortured, taken away, because they wanted freedom for their country. They wanted freedom. They wanted to be able to practice. And so there's tremendous kind of emotion involved. And as you approach Lhasa, you don't see a Tibetan city anymore. As you drive through, I mentioned this before, the first time I went to Tibet, as you drove from the border to Lhasa, everywhere you saw ruins. So a Tibetan doctor mentioned there were 6,000 monasteries, and only 3 remaining, but in actual fact he says much more, because that's just the monasteries, and there were places where lay people practiced, and that's not talking about all the stupas, all the prayer flags, all the prayer wheels, numerous Buddhas and manis that were all carved in the rocks, everything destroyed, everything obliterated, the people forced to do that. So when I first went 15 years ago, you saw these ruins, and of course you felt sad. Now you don't even see the ruins. And you come into a Tibetan village and you don't see anything. You don't see a temple. You just don't see anything. And the people who come, they're like maybe begging for money or just staring at you, but they don't come and ask for pictures of the Dalai Lama. And they really, like, 50 years has passed, 50 years of it being dangerous to openly show anything or communicate. So it's a very, very kind of... And now, of course, you see Chinese soldiers everywhere, and you see nice buildings, Chinese-style, built for the Chinese people, and you see Tibetan falling down places where the Tibetans live, kind of hovels, really, because nothing much has happened for 50 years. And when you come to Lhasa, you see bulldozers, you know, bulldozing down so much of these old buildings, as my friend said to me, they don't ask. They don't ask permission. They just do it. And of course, if you live in a Tibetan house, they make sure you don't get running water, you don't get electricity, so the place just runs down, and then the bulldozers come in, and then suddenly it's like these Chinese streets and Chinese roads, and Lhasa is now a Chinese city with a Tibetan kind of suburb, which is interesting. And of course, the old days, you could just go to these monasteries and you don't have to pay anything. You just go, and of course, they're just so delighted and happy. And now they're museums, and you don't see monks really practicing much, or they're just chanting because they're not allowed to study. And they don't really come up to you much. They don't really talk much to you. And if they do come up to you and talk to you, you're thinking in the back of your mind, these are probably the spies. Because you're going to get in trouble, right? So there's so many spies. So the people who really wanted to study, they left. And now the monasteries are just filled with spies. So, you know, and you get the monks kind of laughing at you almost, making fun of you when you're holding a prayer wheel, which is interesting, in Tibet, in a very holy place. And you know that they have this kind of, they're planted there. And I remember going to a puja in Tashi Lumpo, which is a Panchen Lama's place, which used to be the only active place, amazingly active place, really, because Panchen Lama had remained, and so they had allowed his monastery to be untouched. That's one of the three. Remember I said three? They allowed his monastery. And of course the Panchen Lama, you know, there was this tremendous controversy. They didn't allow His Holiness's choice to be appointed. They appointed their own one. Anyone who objected, the abbot was removed. The whole place was filled with spies. So when we went there and they were doing a big puja, when the puja finished, they were heading off for a three-hour re-education session, which is obligatory at the monasteries. So that's kind of how it is. That's basically how it is. And of course, you know, you go there and you go through the motions and you do what's expected and you give the appearance that they want. And you can't wear your robes, so you're just there as a layperson, because Westerners aren't officially allowed to be monks and nuns, and you're not allowed to do anything to inspire the Tibetans. So you're not allowed to get, you know, my teacher's not allowed to teach, or even for people to come up for blessings, you know, they have to do it privately and quietly. And everywhere you see soldiers. When you come to Lhasa, it's just truck after truck after truck after truck of soldiers. Truck after truck. And of course, it's very sad. Even to go to the Batali, you have to pay so much money. Or we could go every day if we were prepared to pay, I think 91, maybe about $10 or $14. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for a Tibetan. 91. That's a lot of money. I don't know a week's wage, but a lot. And even then, if you could afford it, you can only go about once a month. That's where the Dalai Lama lived. So they don't want people going there too much. Because, of course, you'd have a stream of people praying. So you can walk around it, but you can't go in. Or if you can go in, it's very restricted what you can do. So I remember I was talking about this and how deeply affecting it was. But I remember also talking about the fact that you can't allow yourself to become emotional in that situation. And so the whole trip became an incredible teaching for me. Because I remember the first time that I went, emotion came up and anger came up towards the Chinese. You almost couldn't help it because people were coming up one after another saying how they'd been tortured, how they'd been raped. I mean, like nearly all the nuns were raped, right? It's like, that's what you do. It's like the monks were forced to kill animals. It's like so much destruction. Holy things put all along the road, the most popular road, so that everyone would walk on it. Or toilets, latrines were made that you were forced to use, and all the wood blocks were put there and holy objects were put there. Things were totally destroyed. Holy objects used for bullet practice, things systematically. They had a systematic way of destroying holy places, and of course they would make the people do it. And the people lived in fear. So it was very, very hard when you saw the emotion not to cry, not to feel sad, not to get involved. And of course the result of that was that several months after I came back, I think the Dalai Lama won the Nobel Peace Prize, and there was a huge protest in Lhasa and amazing clampdown. And many of the young monks that had kind of, we felt so hopeful when we went to Sera because people were studying and debating again. They were rounded up, they were taken off, they were tortured, they used cattle prods in the mouth, they had brain damage, that was it, finished. And the message, and young nuns, you know, they were taken off, they were tortured, they were told not to say what had happened to them. But, you know, the lucky ones survived, didn't die, and hopefully managed to make it out of Tibet and be cared for because they need care after that kind of treatment. And this happened all around. You got the message that, you know, Tibet was never going to be independent and you better not do it. You better not say, you know, the minute you're going to say this, it's a bullet. And your family's going to suffer also. It's not just you. If you make a problem, everyone around you suffers. if you, there was an incident when I was there, I think I mentioned it, our tour guide, his friend had gone to one of these karaoke places. So, you know, they make these places attractive and they sort of sell liquor. And he'd drunk a bit too much and he got up on the stage and he said, "Enough is enough." Well, that was it. That was it. He was dragged off that stage. He was taken for interrogation. His entire family was brought in. The wife, the kids. The tour guide, who was his friend, was brought in. I mean, everyone you know and have made contact with, they're going to be rounded up, they're going to be interrogated. And it's not fun being interrogated by Chinese police in a Chinese police station with soldiers. So you don't say those things, even though in your heart you feel enough is enough. But they've learnt not to say it, you see. They've learnt to keep what they feel within. And they've also learnt that the only thing you can do is direct your energy into the Dharma. And so in some ways, for me, it's like having to go through that same experience, because I knew that people that I had taken ordination with in 86 in Bodhgaya with His Holiness, Tibetan nuns who'd walked out of Tibet. I've met them again in Anisangpo, a Tibetan nunnery in Lhasa in 87, and they were the ones who had carried that flag and shouted, "Long live the Dalai Lama," and being tortured, maybe killed. So I knew this, people I'd spoken to. So you don't do it. You don't make eye contact unless you can help it. You try to be really, really low-key. And yet, everyone knows you're a nun. They all knew I was a nun, even wearing lay clothes. I remember walking around the Jokan one day, and I was going round and round, and I had my prayer. I was trying to be discreet, and I thought, you know, I've got a hat on, I'm wearing lay clothes, nobody's going to know I'm a nun. And there's this one woman walking next to me, and there's this little kid, and the little kid looks up at me and he says, "Anila," which means nun in Tibetan. So I thought, you can't fool anyone, because their own nuns have been undercover for so many, many, many years. And they know who's, they know the scene, right? You're coming in fresh, but they know. And they know that you have to be very wise and very clever to survive. And they know that you cannot afford to go to the emotional mind. You can't do it. And even these people this time, who was showing like withered arms, you know, the hotel owner who had, as a 16-year-old girl, as Rinpoche put it, her arm had been destroyed by beating and torture. 16-year-old girl. Not because she'd done anything wrong, because she happened to be from, you know, a good family. Her arm was destroyed. So she's there and, you know, she can't, you know, she has a thing over her hand. Because obviously it's, you know, she dresses really nice, but she tries to hide it. Because when she was young, you know, her arm was destroyed. What else would you do to a 16-year-old girl? Because that's the best thing you can do, isn't it, if you want to destroy someone's life. And someone's very pretty. So you destroy the body a little bit, don't you? They're very smart, they're very clever. And the only way that you can protect yourself is to be equally smart and equally clever. And the way to be really, really smart and really, really clever when there's spies everywhere, when anything that you say or think, almost, because remember there's a culture of fear here. Remember the same thing happened in China. You know, we're talking about a very strong karmic thing. Is to basically not allow yourself to go to the emotional mind, but let things be. Let things be, but in a very, very wise way. So I remember during that talk, that first talk, I mentioned that, and it came to me very strongly, because I was now having to do the same thing that the Tibetans had to do to survive, which was basically to not allow myself to be caught by judgments, opinions, emotions. This is very difficult for us as Westerners, because as Westerners, we have judgments and opinions about everything. I mean, I remember talking to my friend and he said, I've never mentioned this before, but he said, it's really interesting. You put 100 Chinese in a room and you ask them a question. He said, nobody puts their hand up. But he said, if there's one Westerner in that room, even if you don't ask them, they'll put up their hand and give their opinion. You know, we've got a lot of opinions. We've got a lot of thoughts and feelings. And I remember the first trip, it was all coming out, anger, you know, anger. Even you tried not to. But you see, you can't do it anymore. Because who are you going to get angry at anyway? Because these Chinese people who are settling, they're struggling. They're not happy. They're actually worse off than Tibetans because they don't have religion. Because the Tibetans, even though they've never met the Dalai Lama, completely in their hearts, it's like no separation. It's so strong. It's like when you mix milk with water, you cannot separate. The devotion is so strong that you walk in the Patara and you feel like the Dalai Lama just got up and left. It's like he was sitting on that cushion and it's still warm. Because even though the people taking care of the Dalai Lama's quarters have been tortured, and you can see it because you look at their hands and the fingers are broken and they've never mended. And they're like, you can see they've been through years and years of torture and control. They have no control in that place. They're slaves to the people who are running it as a museum. They have to do what they're told. But they are totally free. And they are there taking care of that place. And in their hearts is nothing but the Dalai Lama. Nothing. To the point that, you know, we were taken into secret rooms. And we were told by those old Namgyal monks who went through years and years and years of torture. And remember, there's a camera in every room. They just said to us, please pray for His Holiness because He has so much work to do. And He is Chimrezig. He is the Buddha of Compassion. He took birth to help all beings. When they found Him, you know, my teacher was translating and he broke into tears. Couldn't even translate what they were saying. So when they found the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, he said to them, I have been born to help all sentient beings. And of course, it's what he's doing. He's helping Tibetans, he's helping everyone in the world. He's there as a voice for peace. You might say, well, what's he doing for me? Well, what he's doing is he's providing the voice of peace. He's a spokesman for peace, he's a spokesman for compassion. He's a spokesman for universal love, for Ahimsa, for Gandhi's ideals. You know, he's a spokesman for non-violence. And he's someone who's done it year after year after year. And the most unbelievable odds, the most amazing odds, he's dealing with the Chinese know what to deal with, and he's doing it. And he's going around giving teachings, giving talks. And, I mean, most people just can't get enough of him because he just radiates love and peace and happiness. So, you know, there these guys are, and you know that they have been through it. You know they have seen more suffering in their life than many of us will see in many, many lifetimes. And yet you also see that they have no fear. They're there and they're telling you the truth. And if they get taken off to prison and tortured again for saying it, they don't care. They don't mind. And they're not fussed that they're controlled. Because as far as they're concerned, you know, they can deal with it, and they can deal with it because they don't get emotional about it. They do the work they have to do, and the work they have to do is to keep that place. To keep that place. Keep that place alive. Keep that place so Dalai Lama can go back tomorrow and walk in and, you know, the cushion is still warm. Amazing, yeah. Amazing, after years and years and years. And so you start to realize, because, I mean, you go through a similar kind of karmic experience, being in a place and you can't wear your robes and you can't openly do things. And this is just for a few days. But you start thinking, these guys, 50 years. 50 years. You know, and I'm not being tortured. I'm not being harmed. But you have to go through a similar struggle in your own mind, and you have to come to a similar place of acceptance, but not acceptance in the sense of, well, you know, I think I talked about this maybe last week, you just lie down on the floor and everyone walks over you. Acceptance in the sense that you can allow things to be the way they are, because inwardly you're quite free. You have the most precious thing. And the most precious thing, of course, is the fact that your heart and your mind are free. I mean, you have made your mind rich. You have everything you need. You don't need outside things. You don't need power, authority, control, money. Who cares? You don't need that. You don't need it. And you've seen how all that stuff just gets taken away from you anyway. It's been like going through a prolonged death experience year after year after year. And so, of course, your mind just overwhelms the appearance of the fact that you need a motorbike. Who needs a motorbike? I mean, seriously, they don't need a motorbike. They don't need a computer. They don't need this stuff. They're happy doing what they're doing. What they're doing is serving and being the truth. And their minds are very, very free. And they can just take whatever appearance arises without putting opinions, judgments, whatever. They can go with whatever appearance arises because they are not trapped or controlled by appearances anymore. They're free. Is that communicating? Oh my goodness. This is giving an opportunity, isn't it? But I mean, does it make sense what I'm saying? You're not getting caught in the emotions, but you're like, it just forces you to internalize more and more and more the wisdom, the compassion, the kindness, the love into your heart and into your life. And I often give this example of River Moshe, who says when he was taken off to prison, as he never thought he'd be put in prison, because he was recognized from a young age as a holy being. He went to all his monastic studies. There's no reason that he would ever go to jail, right? Oh, he's not going to ever do anything wrong. And of course, he was doing something wrong according to the Cultural Revolution, because he believed in the religion. And so he said when he was taken off to prison and they searched him and they took away everything and they searched his socks even to see if he had a picture of the Dalai Lama or Mala. Dangerous thing, Amala. He said, it's like, they took everything away from him. And the only thing he had was the study that he'd done, the Dharma that he'd learnt. And he had to use it now. He had to use the wisdom that he had gained from his studies to overwhelm the experiences that he was going to go through. Now that is really what the Buddhist teachings are about. And if you go through the traditional path, you'll find it starts off with devotion. Devotion is a very powerful force that connects you. It connects you, and you know. So I think, okay, the second week, I had to get things in order now. The second week, I remember talking about Buddha nature, and how when you start to become very, very confident, and know. The true nature of your mind is totally pure. There's no reason to suffer. There's no reason to have delusions. It's meaningless. There's no point. It's just you do the work, you can completely eliminate all these causes of suffering, you know, all this stuff. You can become totally pure. And I think I probably gave the example again of His Holiness, because he's always coming up in the examples, because he's just somebody that, you know, you see, you connect with, and you feel, wow, this is amazing. This guy's amazing. And then he's there and he just says, look, I'm here to tell you, you can make your mind totally happy and peaceful forever, all the time. You just got to do the work. You just got to get rid of this stuff that's getting in the way. It's so simple. You don't need it. And most of us, you know, we can't hear that because we just don't believe that we could be pure, that we could be totally kind, that we could be completely wise, that we could be compassionate. We have such a low self-image in the West. We have a low self-image of ourselves, and oh, we don't have a lot of self-hatred and self-pity, and you know, until I talked about this on Friday, how we get caught up in a sad story, or we get caught up in our anger, like, I'm angry, and I'm always going to be angry, and it's never going to change, or I'm jealous, or I have a lot of stuff. You know, we get caught up in all this stuff. And we never kind of put any separation, say, hey, look, I just don't have to buy this stuff. Because instead, we've learned to identify with what is the most deep thing, and the most deep thing is the total fundamental purity. And that's not an ego thing, like going around saying, oh, I'm fundamentally pure. I mean, you can't do that, right? There's no ego. That place where there's purity, there is an ego, there's freedom. And not only is there no ego, but there's the understanding that every single being is the same. It's like nobody actually has to suffer. question nobody asks. There's no reason. It's just all being created by the mind being caught up in the emotional stuff, caught up in the disturbing thoughts. It doesn't have to be there. And so then you go the way of dismantling all that stuff. You do the work you have to do. And everything in life, once you've made the decision to do that work, everything in life is going to appear to you as the teacher. Everything. Everyone who shouts at you, everyone who criticizes you, everyone who gets angry at you, everyone who points out your faults and gives you a hard time, and also all the good things, even small things, are going to start appearing differently to you once you decide that you are going to go that way. What to do? He's an acrobat and he's a performer. And I'm afraid I just can't compete with him. It's like, if you've ever seen him do the triple whirl around that pillar and then into that hole, you'll know. It's hopeless. It's hopeless. He's going to win out, I know. He practices every night. There's a whole family of them, actually. So remember, the third week I was talking about, you know, some methods for this and some methods of connecting, and I talked about prayer. And for me, the prayer is a very, very important subject because it's prayer that connects us with the divine. So if you pray a little bit, then for a little bit you're connected. If you pray more, you're connected more. But if you just try and make your life a life of constant prayer, then your life becomes constant connection. Connection to what? Connection to the divine. Connection to the divine. And divine, remember we talked about, it's not separate from us. It's not separate, because that Buddha nature that is embodied in the holy beings is the same Buddha nature that we have. It's just they did the work. They got there. And so when we pray, we're not only connecting with this divinity outside, but we're also connecting with a divinity that is not separate from us inside, and is actually the only place of refuge and security that we can totally rely on. Because everything else is going to be taken away from us. I mean, you might as well let go. It's all going to go. I mean, house, possessions, family, friends, body, the body, everything. It's all going to go. Everything's going to be taken away. There's nothing to hold on to. Nothing at all. All going to go. Tibetans were fortunate in a way, they witnessed it. Many of them when they were young. Even the monasteries, even the prayers, even the lamas. Nothing out there, even in terms of holy objects. You can't hold on to a single one. The physical object. It's just a physical object. And it can act as an intermediary. It can act as a representation. I often give the example with the Buddhas. Like, people say, why do you have all these Buddhas on the altar? Like, what do you mean take refuge in the Buddha? And I say, look, it symbolizes something which you're trying to represent, but you can't truly represent it in a physical form. You can do your best, but you can only kind of... And then an example that I give is of you know, the Olympic Games. You know, somebody wins the Olympic Games. America's always winning all the medals. I think the rest of the world stopped watching now. I don't know what it was like last time, but the old days when I used to watch, and it's like it was always America. And so, you know, especially the track and the field, right? Very good, yeah. So then there you are, track and field, and another thing has been won, and everyone's on the podium, you know, 1, 2, 3, and it's all America. Or maybe the third one is another country. I'm just joking. I mean, Russia and China win things too. But anyway, so then they win the medal, and what do? They're about to present the medal. Or maybe they've already put the medal around the neck. This is the way it goes. Put the medal around the neck. And then what do? They start to raise the flags, and da 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 rings out through the stadium. And if the games happen to be in America, of course, everyone is standing up. It's like, and you have this close-up shot of this guy with a medal, and there he is, and he's standing there, and he's trained for years to win this medal. And it's like, America, I did this for America. And the tears are coming down, and it's like, you know, flag is going up, tears coming down, flag is going up, tears coming down. Well, he ain't crying because there's a little bit of cloth with some colour, you know. That's not what he's crying about. He's not crying because there's a bit of cloth, is he? Or a bit of sound. He's crying because something beyond that, that he identifies with. He somehow, still he identifies that his country is a place of freedom. Still he has this thought. And, you know, he has proved that you can come from nowhere, and if you put in that effort, you can win. I don't know, trillions of things that America represents to him is being hoisted up with that little bit of cloth. And it means something when he sees it. So it's the same with these Buddha images. It's not a bit of metal. It's something that over the years, more and more and more, as you pray, as you train your mind, as you get more and more understanding of the Buddha and what it means to you inside, what it meant for others, how they were able to do the work, how they were able to gain these incredible experiences and realizations, it just brings so much benefit. It's like it starts to resonate, and you start to see it's like the famous holy statue of the Buddha or the Patala. You go there, and it starts to mean something so deep. The Dalai Lama, 14 of them, 14 of them nurtured and protected Tibet for centuries and made it an incredible Buddhist country. And now one of them is like going all around the world trying to do the same thing for every country. Give it a place, give it a focus, give it people who are well trained. Put well trained Tibetan masters into those countries and give people an opportunity to study something which, even though they don't have to take it and believe it and become it, but it will help. It will somehow spread the whole ideal of peace and goodness and kindness and love. It means something. You know, for them it means something. So this is kind of, how do I get to that subject? So how did I get to the subject? Symbolism and prayer. Yeah, so prayer. But why did I talk about the Buddha and the flag? Yeah, the physical. It doesn't need the physical, right? At the beginning, we need the physical. We need the physical guru. We need to meet the physical guru, and he needs to be kind of like, really, well, this is something special. I would like to be like this. And you make a connection. And you just see them, and a kind of prayer goes out, a wish goes out, an aspiration goes out. So I was using this example when I was talking about prayer. The Dalai Lama walks on the stage. Now, in Shoreline, there's like 7,000 people. Of those 7,000, I think about six, five, had never met the Dalai Lama. It was a lot, because there's a lot of new people. And when it comes to the public talk, what have we got? 19,000. So maybe of those, 17, 16, I've never met. But then I walks onto the stage and, you know, the hands are together and he bows and he smiles and he's on the big screen and everyone stands up and they look at him and there's some kind of connection happens. And they feel warmth and they feel kind of like, I like this guy. He talks my language. And you're talking about people from every field. Somehow there's that kind of response. You rarely talk to people. Now, I never met anyone after Shoreline who said, well, I didn't think that much of him. I haven't heard that. Instead, I keep bumping into people. And you know, they said, where do you come from? Ellen B. said, oh, it was an issue. I said, oh, it was so special. And they're almost like tears in their eyes. And they're not Buddhists. They're not going to become Buddhists. But somehow they felt like, you know, he talks my language. I like that guy. It's interesting, yeah? So he walks down the stage and does this, and he starts talking, and what does he talk about? He talks about peace. He talks about we're all the same. We don't want to suffer, we want happiness. And he just kind of, in a talk, he will go through everything in simple terms, simple language, and everyone in the audience gets something. and comes home with this warm, fuzzy feeling, like, I like that guy. He's cool. He's good. You know, I wish the Tibetans well. I mean, he's nice. I like him. You know, if he comes back, I'm coming again. And this is people, many people get dragged. You know, we've had people come here, and we had one guy came and he did 8 nunes. Before that, he did medicine Buddha. And he's somebody who's a self-confessed someone who was dragged, not wanting to go to a public talk. Like, Dalai, who? You know, what is he? Who cares? You know, but there's nowhere else to go, and it's a Friday, it's Saturday night, and okay, all right, I guess, we'll go. And that's it. It's like, somehow, he sees him, he meets him, the heart opens. And I'm saying, like, it's like something about what he represents. It's like your heart opens, the prayer goes out, and it's not even felt as though it's a prayer. It's just a kind of resonance. I like that guy. He's cool. I'd like to be like that. I mean, he has the values I really cherish and I look for and I respect. And somehow, there's some kind of thing happens and there's connection and there's an aspiration goes out. And from that moment on, I'm sorry, everyone, you're finished. Because from that point on, the seed is in your mind and you'll get enlightened. It doesn't matter how long it will take because the prayer has gone out. And if you want to do it fast, then you keep that connection and you keep the little flame in your heart that got lit that night, you keep it burning. You keep it burning and you increase the flame more and more and more. And you start to find that this guy who walked onto that stage is becoming more and more of your life. And you're reading more and more of his books and you're hearing him and you're bumping into other people who meet him. And as even you go to other talks or things, it's like things he said are coming back. And you start to find that there doesn't have to be any separation between you and him because somehow it's not a guy who walked on the stage. That's not what happened. I mean, physically, a guy walked on stage, right? But actually what happened is a little flame was lit in your heart. And that flame was the flame of goodness, the flame of truth, the flame of those things that you truly, truly believe in and wish you could be, and wish others could be. It's the flame of compassion, it's the flame of loving kindness, it's the good heart, it's the universal responsibility. And it got lit. And even you try and cover it up, it's not going to go away. It's not going to go away. And when you look at the picture, you're going to feel that flame again. And you're going to come to a point where you don't want that flame to go. You want that flame to get brighter and brighter and brighter. Till it's the same as that flame that was in his heart. And it's not even about him in some ways, you see. Because it's about you, it's about you connected with your own inner truth, your own inner wisdom, your own inner goodness, and you start to find that you don't want to leave it. You start to find that actually that is the most important thing in your life. And other things just don't seem so important anymore. They get overwhelmed by this kind of sense of an innate joy when you can be kind. I was sort of feeling like, well, you know, everybody is like me. It's true what he said. I mean, I never kind of thought about it that way before, but actually it kind of makes sense. And the more you have that kind of thought, and the more you want that flame to be there, you're going to find that everything supports that flame becoming brighter and brighter. And of course, at the same time that flame becomes brighter, you're going to meet a lot of challenges and difficulties. But all those challenges and difficulties are simply to make the flame stronger. They say that for a Dharma practitioner, all the difficulties that they face, you can tell if someone is truly practicing because whatever difficulties they go through, it strengthens their practice. And there you have it back in Tibet. And you see it's a strong devotion. Like you can never experience here in the West, because in the West we don't know this word devotion so much in some traditions. So I remember last week, you know, I told the story about the old mother who seemed like she was a non-entity, poor sad old woman, lived and died, you know, died alone in this apartment, and her only possession is this book, this old book that she can't even read, and the kids had gone and the kids didn't listen to her. and you know, the husband had gone and all her jewelry gone, everything had been taken away from her. But the twist to the story is that all the words that this old woman said couldn't be understood by the children until after she died, because her inner experience was so rich that by having her children taken away from her, she was able to come to such a deep union with God. And we're talking Islam now. That even though she could not read this book, which was an interpretation of the Quran that she cherished so much as a physical manifestation of the divine in her life, even though she could not read the words, she knew the meaning. She was the meaning. She was the meaning. I remember when I was talking about that, and so she was the richest person she had accomplished in her life. And whatever difficulties she faced, it didn't matter, because she used it to get stronger and stronger and stronger. And of course, after she died, the kids suddenly realized who she was and what she was. That their mother was an angel. She was a truly, truly spiritual woman. And they suddenly realized why she didn't go to the mosque. She didn't need to go. She didn't need the institution. And why she spent so much time alone. And yet she would say to them, you just do not realize how great the blessings of God are. And they're like, what are you talking about? And there they are getting on with their education and, you know, buying a new car and having a new boyfriend. And they couldn't hear it. They couldn't hear it. That she didn't need those things, because she had internalized, just like those old Tibetan monks who'd been tortured for years, her particular form of being thrust deeper and deeper into the spiritual path by having everything that a normal person would cling to and need, you know, the family situation, the comfort, the security, the kids, taken away from her. And she had nothing to do but internalize. She couldn't even read the book, so she had to become the book. She had to be the book. I remember when I was talking about prayer, I talked about those monks who entered into the monastery. And the first thing they do, those monks and nuns, they memorize all these texts. And so I stayed in the nunnery for 10 days, and I was saying my experience in this nunnery. 10 days, everywhere's a nun. All different tones firing off everywhere. You have these nuns chanting these texts because they're memorizing. And that's how you memorize. You give a little twist, you give a little jig, and you just have to go over and over again until it's in your head, and then you have to go over it again. And they don't know what they're saying. They know the word, but they haven't put this stuff together. It's beyond them. And as they go through their studies, when they get older, those texts they memorized as young kids and had to keep repeating to themselves over the years, they start to study. And then they start to understand. And as they become older and older and they practice, eventually they become the meaning of those words that at the beginning were just words. At the beginning, all the prayers we do are just words. They're just words, but that's okay, because every single word, every single imprint, we can't imagine how we are affecting this mind by putting precious words on it, like loving kindness, compassion, bodhicitta. It's so strong, it's so powerful. Images, the Dalai Lama's smile, the medicine Buddhas, they're communicating so much. You can look at a photo and there's so much in it. So every time we do this, as I was mentioning that when I was in Tibet, you go from temple to temple, and then my teacher, he would not walk past a text or a statue of the Buddha or a monk without making offering, without praying. And so this incredible accumulation of images, and all these images of these smiling beings just kind of representing their truth. And you're praying, can I become like you? Can I get bodhicitta quickly like you? Can I benefit others as you did? Can I, you know, please help me to gain perfect wisdom? Please help me to do great extensive work for others. This is how you're praying. You're not praying for, you know, can I get a better car and pass my exams? And so I mentioned this when I was in Singapore. So many of the prayers are like totally worldly. It's like health, long life, success in business, examinations, pass my driving test. This is what they're praying for. But they forget it, you know, because this is not how you use the Buddha and the Buddha's precious teachings. You pray, as Riva Rinpoche said, you pray for those things you cannot do yourself yet, but you pray to be able to do them. And you know that by making those prayers, eventually you will become those prayers that you have made. So the Dalai Lama, as I mentioned, you know, he walks onto the stage and he is the accumulation of so many lifetimes of prayers that he has made and others have made, and it's like the match striking and there's light. I remember somebody, one of my friends, he told me years and years ago, he went to Woodstock, and at Woodstock they were all told to light a match. So everyone lit a match simultaneously, and it was a very strong experience. They're all standing there holding that light. And it's like that when the Dalai Lama walks on stage, you know, it's like everyone strikes that match. And according to your ability, according to your prayers, according to your imprints, it's lit. Something is there. There's something to work with. And of course, he has made so many prayers that he's become this. You know, what has he prayed for? To benefit extensively anyone that he meets or sees or touches. And so when he meets and sees and touches, he benefits. And of course he goes around the world meeting and seeing and a lot of people. By newspaper, by television, by radio, by book, by cassette, by email, by internet. I mean, you ask him, it's like they're using everything. Making contact. And it's always meaningful. Why? We can't do that, right? We're limited. I mean, if we can just help one or two or three people, it's great. But people like Dalai Lama, or like my teacher who spent years and years of his previous life praying, they can spend the entire life doing incredible projects, having many, many students, giving deep advice and counsel, and being able to benefit, you know, from schools, hospices, not just Buddhist teachings, whatever's needed they're able to do because of those prayers. So prayer has this amazing function of connecting us, like going online and staying online with these holy beings who prayed. And just making that connection constant. And I mentioned this one prayer, you know, many, many years ago. My teacher said, if you pray like this, you'll become like this. And the prayer was, anyone just by seeing and hearing, remembering, talking, touching, thinking about me, be free from all their suffering, you know, achieve every happiness. And you pray like that every day. And as you're praying that, what are you doing? The actual motion and mental activity, the mental movement of saying those words internally is transforming and molding your mind into that. The prayer itself is meaningful. It's not even like it has to be actualized straight away. Just by having that thought, you are, you know, the word we use is blessing, jinlab. You're blessing your whole mind, your whole life by thinking that way. And what is the meaning of blessing? The meaning of blessing is transformation. You're changing. You know, before, what did we used to think? We used to think, oh, you know, what am I going to do today? Where should I go for my holidays? And who should I call? You know, where should I go tonight? Where should I have... I mean, you're not thinking like that. Now you're filling your mind and you're trying to make the prayer strong and constant. And as the prayer becomes stronger and more constant, you find that the teacher is always there. They're not separate. Because they never are separate from your mind anyway. The Dalai Lama walked onto that stage because he was already in your heart. He is not separate from your own mind ever, because all those qualities that you saw represented outside are all inside, waiting to be developed as you do the work you have to do. And you start to find, as you pray more and more, that the whole life becomes prayer. The actions become prayer. The words become prayer. The thoughts become prayer. And you're connected. And you're not just connected with these holy beings, because you're making the same prayers as them. So basically, you're making your mind the same as their mind. Because what are the kind of things we pray for? We pray to extensively benefit. That's what we pray for. We pray to become enlightened so that we can lead every single being from suffering. And we're talking about every single, we're talking about every bird that we hear, every worm that we see, every spider in the bathroom. You know, somehow we can't do it now, but in the future we're going to benefit this being. I mean, I'm going to get in line for this being. And at the beginning you're saying words, but eventually this is what I'm going to do. You become stronger and stronger, more and more connected. And so you're not just connecting through your devotion with the energy of all these beings who made prayers, and therefore it's like putting the plug in the electricity and receiving all their blessings, all their help. I mean, you're going to receive, if you make this kind of prayer, you're going to receive all the help you need. Don't think your life will be easy though. It won't. But you'll receive everything you need to be able to do that work. But you're also, you see, connecting with every sentient being. There's two connections happening. Devotion is connecting you. You're becoming, you're transforming your mind into what? Into the Dalai Lama's mind. Through prayer, through having the same kind of way that he thinks, which, until it's introduced to us, basically is pretty foreign, right? I mean, when we went through school, college, university, I mean, the teacher didn't come in and say, okay, do you know what will really, really help you in your life? If you pray that anyone who sees, hears, they don't tell you that, right? I mean, they put all this other stuff, I know, I've done it, they put all this other stuff into you. And even when they say really cool, nice things, they often walk out the door and do something totally different. So you start getting pretty disillusioned. And even the institutions don't support them saying that. I'm not sure if you can even teach religion actually now. I think, I don't know, only in a broad base of it, you know. So you're connecting. You're putting the plug. You're putting the plug into the current, the electricity, and you're transforming your mind into the Buddha's mind, into the Dalai Lama's mind, into the pure mind, your own potential, the thing that's going to make you truly, truly happy, the thing that's going to make you truly, truly happy. It's basically to get rid of the ego. It sounds crazy at the beginning. You have to have some kind of experience of what it's like to actually just stand up against this thing which is constantly throwing us from place to place with its needs and its wants and its opinions and its judgments and trapping us constantly. I must say, when I came out of Tibet, it's a very interesting experience to come back to Nepal. And in Nepal you have all these monasteries and you have all this supposed freedom. Well, there is truly a lot of freedom. You can study. You can do a lot. But it became very clear to me that the big obstacle there was that, you know, the guys there want to have a motorbike. They want to go to the West where the streets are paved with gold and you maybe even can buy yourself a car. And they have real dollars. I mean, you get paid in dollars in America. Amazing, isn't it? We figure, like, who cares? But they think that's important because it's distraction, isn't it? You may even end up studying so you can go to the West and get this stuff. And then what happens? You get to the West and it's like, whoa, this is really cool. You know, this is better than being a monk. I'm sorry to say the words, it's horrible. Oh, it's terrible. And all that stuff, all that precious, precious stuff that they had, because they didn't realize that it's not true happiness. We know that. In many ways, we're very, very fortunate in the West because, you know, we know, especially Silicon Valley, if you had trillions of dollars, you don't have it anymore. You have a huge mortgage, a lot of debt, and it's hard to find a job. I mean, it's hard, it's a struggle, and you've still got the kids, and you've still got the college education, and the health care, and the insurance, and, you know, you have to get a new car, and it's difficult, and they need fed, and the prices are all going up. I mean, I just went out shopping today. I haven't been out shopping in America for a couple of months, I think, because, you know, I was away. And it seems like every single price in the stores just suddenly went up. So I figure all the storekeepers are having a hard time, and they're trying to get more money because people ain't buying. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it's like, this is what it seems like, yeah? I mean, you still have to pay the bills. Even money costs water. My water costs money. Okay, even water costs money. Isn't that true? Yeah. Even water, I mean, this stuff costs money. And even the stuff that comes from the tap costs money. Huh? A lot of money. Costs a lot of money, this. If you translate this into certain many currencies, it's a lot of money for that. That, you know. And you need more than that for a day to survive. So their big obstacle, of course, is materialism. The mind gets totally distracted. You want to watch a movie, you want to see TV. Now, you don't get that in Tibet. They basically do not care about motorbike. Because if you have some understanding and faith and devotion, and it's taken root in your heart, you've been through so much suffering, you've had everything taken away from you, you've been tortured, you've been beaten. Okay, you need enough money to survive, but once you're surviving, you invest your body, speech and mind, your precious, precious human life, which could be taken away from you any moment. River Rinpoche used to say, you really, you know, in Tibet in the old days, you really did very strong purification and practice at night before you went to bed, because the knock on the door was going to come in the early hours of the morning. And you didn't know that you were going to be alive the next day. You could be dragged off, interrogated, and that was it. So you better be prepared before you go to sleep. We're kind of like, oh, I didn't do my commitments tonight. Oh, it doesn't matter, I'll do it tomorrow. Or, oh, I'm really tired because we're watching TV. Oh, well, I don't know. This is like, it's like there's an urgency about this. There's an urgency. I mean, it takes effort and it takes some time and energy to transform this mind. We've got so many imprints, basically of rubbish. Oh, and I'm sorry, but it's true. I gave this example, you know, I come back from Tibet after 21 days of every statue, every book, praying, 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 amazing holy objects, self-manifesting. Statues that talked, statues that fly, statues that do this and that, you know, holy objects and holy beings. And your mind, the accumulation on your mind stream, you're flying. You really feel like, wow, amazing, incredible what I can do with this life. And then I was saying, you know, I've got a long journey back. It's like 3 days. And then I'm staying at the nunnery and I'm doing retreat 10 days. So intense. I had so much practice to do. I mean, the nuns were saying, we saw this Western nun, Inji nun, we saw her arrive. Where is she? We haven't seen her. I said, you know, I don't have time to come out. Sometimes I go on the roof, but basically I just have to practice. And all the time you're hearing the sound of these prayers, da 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 da, the sound of the Dharma, the sound of the truth, pouring out of these little beings, precious holy sounds, blessing the mind, and you're doing practices. And you can't imagine what that's like. It's like the strongest kind of cleanser. You know, if something's like really totally dirty and filthy, and you go in there and you scrub it till it's bright. It's like that when you practice. If you do strong practice, your mind really gets cleaned out. And when your mind gets cleaned out, you really notice when there's filth around. You start getting to the point where you just don't want it. It's like you don't want anger because it's so horrible. You don't want to have these minds. You don't want to have these minds. It's like, you know, the person who's showing you this stuff, they're helping you because you've got to clean this stuff out. Got to get rid of it. It's too painful now. So all this accumulation, and here I am, 3 days journey to get back on the airplane, and I end up on this the longest flight, which is a transatlantic from Hong Kong, Cathay Pacific, Hong Kong to San Francisco, SFO, and you know the little TVs embedded in the front seat. And normally I don't ask for headphones. I always say I don't want them, but somehow she'd given them to me. And the little screen won't go off. I keep pushing all the buttons. It goes off for a while. Pom! It's on again. Pom! It's on again. I can't get rid of this thing. And I've got like 14 hours. And of course, pom! And not only pom, but it kind of looks a little bit interesting. So I thought, you know, I really ought to know what's going on in the world. I haven't got a clue. And so I started looking at some of these movies, and it's within about 10 minutes, the images that I saw were just unbelievable. In 10 minutes, you know, guys bombing up other guys, whacking them, punching them, blood pouring from them. And this is in the context of he's a good guy, bashing up the bad guy. So you're supposed to think, oh great, he's gonna escape. Great, you know, this is what's coming in your mind. Oh great, you know, he's beating up all these bad guys, bombs going off and people die, but they're the bad guys, so it's okay, right? Just wipe them out. And the bad guys, of course, are doing bad guy things, which they also show you, so that you don't mind if they're blown up and bashed and killed and bombed because they're bad guys. So what are they doing? They're like putting a live snake down somebody's throat. Somebody must have seen this movie. Come on, what is it? I'm waiting for someone who's seen this movie to tell me what it's called. And to tell me the main actor. Because, you know, they show you the new releases. Anyway, they literally show this picture of a guy and his mouth is forced open. It's horrible, isn't it? We watch this stuff all the time. You know, like Seven, all these movies that we watch, it's like unbelievable, the imprints on our mind. And then we wonder why we have so much fear and anxiety in our minds and why we get scared at night and why we can't sleep. I mean, I could tell you the answer. It's like we have so much of this stuff. So the guy's mouth is forced open and a live snake. Anyone seen this? Come on, come on. Okay, you guys don't go watch this kind of movie. Okay. Huh? You don't? All right. But you know we did, right? We all did. We all have. Isn't it? No? Other kinds of stuff. Well, I'm sure. Okay, I confess. Oh, you never saw this kind of movie. No, it exists, this movie. And there's a live snake. His mouth is forced open and it's fed down his throat. Oh, come on. Nobody ever watched Vietnam movies? Come on. Huh? Nobody ever watched... Huh? Come on. All you ever watched is Bambi, right? Nobody ever watched... what's that one? What's my favourite Vietnam movie? You know, Heart of Darkness, George Joseph Conrad. Yeah, Apocalypse Now. Nobody ever watched Apocalypse Now. Nobody ever watched these Oliver Stone ones. Yeah. I mean, just watching 7-Eleven. I mean, 7-Eleven. Done it again. I've done it again. I'm very sorry. 9-11, I meant. I'm getting in big trouble saying 7-Eleven. Yes. What did you say, Steve? 7-Eleven's
horrible.
Yeah. just watching 7-Eleven. Yeah, it's very scary, yeah. It's the guy behind a counter, you know, with a big sign, we have no cash. Yeah.
No change.
No change given or something. I'm like, even if you shoot me, you won't get any money. So, incredible the accumulation of this stuff that we have, that we're watching, that we're reading, that we've been brought up with, that we've heard, that we've rejoiced about. You know, during the Gulf, not the Gulf War, but the, actually I was here during the Gulf War, and I remember even in the office, I was in Boston, in the office we had a little TV and we're all going watching. We go, hey, what's happening, you know? It was extraordinary. And then they moved into, what was it, the recent one, Yugoslavia? Bosnia. By the time it got to Bosnia, actually, I was living in Ireland, in this remote little island, remote little place, and we had the CNN, of course, by then. And they were watching the thing, and a friend of mine who's still in Bosnia, who went in, American friend, very, very kind person, very, very sincere person, a very good practitioner. He actually went after the war to help, and he's still there rebuilding. And he used to send out these emails, and he said more shocking than all the things that he saw that had happened and done in a very short space of time. You know, hell can happen like that. Hell can happen like that. One minute you're in your village, your friends, with everyone who's this or that religion, you don't care. The next minute these guys are raping and torturing and taking everything from you. Hell can happen like this. This is how quickly karmic appearance can change. So fast. Just like 9-11. You're sitting in an office building, you're chatting to your wife, everything's cool, and suddenly, pow, something just happened in the other building. But it couldn't happen to me. And it does. I want to say this. The most shocking thing he told me, more than all the cruelty that he saw, was all the tourists who came, who wanted to stop and gawk at all the gory things because they'd watched it on CNN and would get in the way of genuine help missions. You know, very hard for him to accept. What were you going to say, Steve?
I was going to say today, I think, is the anniversary of Hiroshima.
Is it? Yeah. Amazing. Oh, well, I dedicate this talk to that. So all this accumulation, so of course there's an effect. And what we're trying to do now is we're trying to put the mind in the white side, the white place. And prayer helps us to do that, you see. It connects us. It keeps our mind in virtue. If you keep your mind in virtue, really your life will transform and change. You're connecting them with all the prayers, all the holy beings. And we said this many times, the example is like the sun, which shines everywhere. The Buddha's love, the Buddha's compassion is everywhere. The Dalai Lama, so many times, the end of teaching, saying to people, okay, now we're leaving, now the teaching's finished, but if you keep me in your heart, I always keep you in my heart, and there will be no separation. And he means that. And you see in Tibet, those people, they come to my teacher, they're old, they've been tortured, they've been wizened, they've seen so much, and what do they say? Please pray for the Dalai Lama, because they don't care about anything else. And what do they mean when they say Dalai Lama? They mean all the goodness in the world, in people's hearts, in my heart. Because it's kind of transcending that physical form, do you see? It's like representing something to them. And they have connected with that. And they know it's important to have these physical representations for other people to connect with. It's important to have them in the world. Difficult to create such a being who's been through all these experiences, has such authority, and is out there going around doing what he's doing. Very important he lives long. Do you see what I mean? Very important. They know it. They've felt it. They've been through torture. There's so many stories of nuns that go through this torture and he's there. They see him. They see him there. And they don't suffer. Amazing stories. So you feel it in Tibet. You feel like the Dalai Lama's there. It's like, he's here. Why do you feel he's here? Because devotion. Because it's totally like, you know, the plug is in, the electricity's flowing. They don't have to go and have tea with him every day. It doesn't matter. He's with them. Do you see what I mean? It's like the connection is there. I told this story several times about the landslide. My teacher said when he was young, you know, the Sherpas, they're going through the mountains, they're walking over these landslides. And when they get to the landslide, he said, all these Sherpas and whatever, they've all been going blah, 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 blah. Get to the landslide, and landslides are kind of scary places because every so often, and the rocks come down, and you never know when it's going to happen. And you basically take your life in your hands and you run. That's all you can do. But if you're a merchant or a traveller, as they are, and they've got pack animals and they're carrying little kids, it's very scary. Because any moment when you're walking across, and you're hearing this as you're approaching it. So what do you do? He said he remembers vividly as a young child being carried. And when they got to the landslide, so everyone's going blah, blah, blah. When they got to the landslide, everything stopped. And everyone started to pray. Whatever they could do, Guru Rinpoche, Om Mani Padme Hum, refuge prayer, whatever it was, they prayed like mad till they got over that landslide. They said when they got over the landslide, blah, blah, blah again. And then the rocks would go, poof. But he said they got over the landslide, and he said it was amazing. Those few minutes when everyone was quiet and praying, you felt like total connection. The whole energy changed. And he said, he always felt really sad that when they got over the landslide, they stopped the connection. And they went back to the blah, blah, blah. But you see, that's what we do. We don't keep the connection. So therefore, blah, blah, blah comes back. So prayer is actually our protection. You know, the beginning, it connects us, then it protects us, then it allows us to receive all the blessings, all the sunlight, all the warmth, all the love, all the energy. And then you see, the more you pray and you keep your mind in a virtuous space, the more you're going to start, you see, the more connected you are with your own divine place, you see, that holy place within you, that secure place within you, that Buddha place within you, because that's what's connecting. It ain't the garbage mind that's connecting, it's deeper than that. The mind that prays sincerely is the heart that's connecting with the Buddha heart, the Guru's heart.